Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Lawrence Wright, who is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and whose new book is The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Path to 9/11. Larry, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you, Harry.
Where were you born and raised?
Oklahoma City. I was born in Oklahoma City and lived there in Oklahoma for a few years. And then my father was a banker, and we moved to Texas, to Abilene, and then to Dallas, which is where I went to high school.
And looking back, how did your parents shape your thinking about the world?
Well, they were extremely formative, of course. My father was a real hero to me. He'd grown up on the Dust Bowl in Kansas, and had gone off to fight in World War II and in Korea, so he was gone for some portion of my childhood. And he came from very straitened circumstances and made a real success of himself. And he's just a really fine man, so I always feel like that he's over my shoulder. And my mother was more the great appreciator. And I have two sisters, and we're all three writers.
Hmm.
And I often think that the reason for that is that she was such a devoted reader that we finally came to the conclusion the way to get her attention was to write that book. And so we all succeeded in that.
So did the family subscribe to The New Yorker?
Oh, my mother loved The New Yorker. And it was a great day when I became a staff writer there. In her ideal life, she would have been sitting at the Algonquin Round Table with the great wits of that era.
And when did you know that you wanted to be a writer? Was it after you went to college, or just coming out of this home life that you've just described?
I had a yearning to be a writer, but I didn't. You know, in Dallas, it was unheard of. We didn't have permission to be writers. We didn't take ourselves seriously.
Yes. I
in high school, I enjoyed writing compositions and essays, and I studied English literature in college, so I had an inclination that way, but I didn't know what it would take or how to go about it.
And what were your first writing positions? I think you were at a number of publications before you actually went to The New Yorker.
Oh yeah. I lived in Cairo from 69 to 71 and taught over there, and then when I came back, I began looking for a job. And it was an era when all the jobs were taken by young men like me, young white guys.
Mm-hmm.
And newspapers in particular were looking to expand to get women and minorities. And so I had a hard time finding a position. And ironically, I got a job at the Race Relations Reporter as their white writer. Really, I was their only writer for a long time, but they called me their white writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I covered the end of the civil rights era. And then after that, I went to Atlanta and wrote for another civil rights organization, and then for a small magazine in New York called New Times. All these magazines I put out of business. One after another, they failed as I was working for them. It was a rocky time in the magazine world. And then I finally hooked up with Texas Monthly and moved to Austin, where I still live. And then worked for Rolling Stone, and then in 1992 joined the staff of The New Yorker.
So before we talk about your new book and your interest in terrorism, I'm curious, what does it take to be a writer? What skills do you think are very important, both on the writing side but also on the research side?
I can only speak for my own experience, mm-hmm. Harry. I always feel that nonfiction writing, which is what I specialize in, is mainly important information stylishly arranged. And so the first part of it is the information. And getting, good details, getting the meat, but also the spice. That's really important, and it requires a whole lot of reporting. So my work is always front-end loaded. It's, most of the work is in the research. And it's not just that when I go out to write a story that I then come back and write it. I go out and then start writing it and continue the research because I know that, you know, there's a blank spot here. And so as much research is done when I'm home as when I'm out in the field. Then, for me, I always use note cards, and I put all my information on note cards, and I outline it that way as well. And I tend to write scenically, partly because of my experience as a movie writer, but I was always inclined to do that anyway. I like to find scenes that exemplify the dilemmas and the characters that I'm trying to sketch out. So if I can find good scenes and find ways to get from one scene to another, and then enlist all the information that I've acquired, that's basically how I put the research to service of the writing.
Over the years, you've actually done a number of books, none really focused on what 9/11 is about.
Right.
You've written a book on twins. You've written a book about religious figures in the United States, among others that I recall at this moment. What drew you into these topics? And then we can talk about what drew you into terrorism.
I guess I've always been interested in why people believe what they believe. You know, we live in a country where you can believe anything you want, and therefore belief takes a lot of different forms. And yet, you know, religion or spirituality or, you know, any kind of strong political belief, for the most part, belief is one of those things that's undervalued in journalism. It's a little embarrassing. You know, for instance, the religion editor has about as much status at a newspaper as the obituary or the cooking, you know, editors. And yet, people are far more motivated by their political, I mean, by their religious beliefs than they often are by their political ones. And so I myself went through a period of, you know, strident religious belief when I was in high school. And I suppose that marked me with a certain interest and respect and maybe a little fear of the potency of religious belief. And so that's been a theme in my work. It took me years to realize that it was playing out in my life. I didn't realize it was something I was continually investigating, but it's always been an element in my work.
And is that does that come out of your personal story? Does it come out of growing up in Dallas, or was it an interest that emerged as you developed as a writer and as a person?
It did come out of personal experience in that, you know, I went through an extremely religious phase in high school and then lost that. And it was, but I know what it is to have strong beliefs. And I know the consolation that those beliefs can provide. And I never have replicated, never found that again. And I'm not really looking that hard for it now. But it was something that I realized could entirely transform a person's personality. And, you know, I've been in prisons, for instance, where I've seen, you know, the religious faith be very transformative in a person's character. But I've also seen so much in the Middle East, the damage that religion does. And, you know, these are, after all, mental artifacts that really separate us and yet can be really powerfully creative or destructive.
Well, one of the shocking things, I guess, that we discovered as a result of 9/11 was how much we didn't understand about people's religious beliefs and how they could affect individuals and international politics. So in a way, what you're saying is you were positioned just out of your own personal development
right.
to be prepared to address some of these issues that became very important. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think also that I had lived in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
I taught English at the American University in Cairo for 2 years, 69 to 71. So I had some experience of living in an Islamic country. I had studied Arabic at the time for fun, not for any other reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked being there. You know, I had a good time in Cairo. I loved the Egyptian people. So I was fond of that culture. And that's one of the reasons it was such a crushing experience to have that culture that I admired so much in many ways and was so fond of attack the culture that I lived in.
You wrote a story and then a screenplay which resulted in a movie which came out in 1998 called The Siege,
right,
which I reviewed in preparation for this interview, and I was immediately struck by how prescient this film was, even to the extent that when I first saw it in 98 or 99, I wasn't able to appreciate it. Was it harder to do a work on terrorism as a screenplay than this book that you did? Talk about the difference in those two projects.
Well, this project began when a producer named Linda Obst approached me to write a script. Her idea was a woman in the CIA. It was more of a notion than a real movie idea, but we spent about a year with me prospecting ideas. But the Cold War was over, and it was difficult to see who the enemy was. And I finally recognized that the CIA did have a real-life antagonist, and it's the FBI.
Which is one of the important themes there, yeah.
So once I realized that, the question was, what were they fighting over? And what they really were fighting over in the mid-90s when I was working on this project was who was going to be in charge of controlling terrorism inside the U.S. They're both struggling for this franchise. And so that became the aperture that the script is built upon. And I went to New York and talked to some counter-terrorists in the FBI. It was ironic, as it turned out, because it prefigured what would happen with my book. And I was very surprised at their anxiety, their level of anxiety, even then, about the possibility we're going to be attacked by some radical Islamist group, and it was going to do a lot of damage. And I didn't have those same anxieties at the time. We had been attacked in 93, the World Trade Center bombing in 93, and there had been a plot that had been squashed to blow up the Lincoln and Holland tunnels and various other landmarks in New York. But we hadn't really felt that we were under attack. These people in New York, the FBI Bureau in New York, saw what was coming. And the movie really reflected their anxieties that I was able to channel in the movie.
And when one sees the movie today, and I recommend it, everybody should run out to the video store and see it. There are a number of themes that really become terribly important after the events of 9/11, the threat to civil liberties. Mm-hmm. As you've already mentioned, the fight within the intelligence and police agencies in the United States between them about who would control this this turf and so on. And this was a product of your research, I guess, is what you're saying, as you explored this idea of what kind of movie to make.
Well, it was a movie of ideas, and the idea that we were posing in there, that Ed Zwick, who I worked with, was the director, what would happen to our country if terrorism came to our shores the way that it already had in London or Paris, not to mention Tel Aviv, but just already in those Western cities, they're experiencing a rather high level of terror within those countries. What would happen if it were in New York? And so, once that premise is posed, it then becomes an examination of our culture, and you know, how would we treat it? And the movie, unfortunately, you know, the plot lines of the movie, it so replicates what actually occurred. You know, the rounding up of Arabs, army in the streets of New York, torturing suspects, all of those things were, to some extent, predictable.
Mm-hmm. So let's show the book, and now let's talk about the book. The book is, as I said, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, published by Knopf. And I think I would like to begin with a quote, as you quote Osama bin Laden at a wedding, and this is the source of your title. At a wedding before the 9/11 attack was launched, he quoted from the fourth surah of the Quran, and he repeated it three times. And the line is, "Wherever you are, death will find you, even in the looming tower."
Mm-hmm.
So what was your goal here in writing this book, and how did you set about doing it?
I wanted to understand, you know, who these people were and why they had attacked us. You know, the most elemental question that we were all asking after 9/11. The level of our cultural ignorance is hard to overstate. And in my own, you know, even though I had spent time in the Middle East and had written this movie, I still was left with many riddles that I needed to unscramble. And so I originally, my first goal was, you know, how am I going to write about it? Where do I start? And what kind of, you know, book would it be? And I felt instinctively that it had to be about individuals. It had to have certain stories that would personalize this massive tragedy and help us understand it through their lives. And I was in Austin, and you know, the planes were all grounded. I couldn't get to the scene of the crime. You know, I was stuck. So I started scanning obituaries that were streaming online at the time. On the Washington Post site, I ran across this obit for John O'Neill, who had been the head of the FBI's counterterrorism division in New York and had gotten fired because he had taken some classified information out of the office. The obituary made it sound like he was something of a disgrace. And paradoxically, he had gotten a job as the head of security at the World Trade Center. And so he died that day. And I didn't know if he was a hero or a villain, but it was, you know, here was our chief bin Laden hunter, and instead of getting bin Laden got him. So I thought, that's a story. You know, whether good or ill, you know, he can take the reader into a world that's a part of the 9/11 journey. So I wrote about him. And then, you know, I was all this time trying to get into Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis wouldn't let me in. So I went to Egypt, where I used to live, and I decided I'd write about the number two man, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the physician that's always at bin Laden's side. And it was really, I had a lot of good, bad luck. You know, the fact that the Saudis wouldn't let me in allowed me to understand al-Qaeda in a completely different way, as a predominantly Egyptian organization, that it was Zawahiri, the ideologue, the man with the actual organization and the skills, who surrounded bin Laden with his Egyptians and created what is al-Qaeda, really a vector of these two forces.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote about him next. And then finally, after a year and 4 months of pleading with the Saudis, I realized they weren't going to let me in as a journalist. And so I took a job. Once again, a really good piece of bad luck, because instead of being a reporter in a hotel making calls, I had an apartment, I had a car, had to go to work every day. I had these young reporters. I was mentoring young reporters in Jeddah.
Saudis, yeah.
In bin Laden's hometown. And I was able to get much more deeply engaged with Saudi society than I could possibly have otherwise. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that Bin Laden was the third life that I was chronicling. And while I was there, I had the opportunity to meet Prince Turki Al-Faisal, who had been the head of Saudi intelligence, had worked with Bin Laden, and is now the ambassador to the U.S. And I realized that he could take the reader into yet another part of this story. Mm-hmm. So with these four main characters, I realized that their interweaving biographies would make the story of 9/11 for me.
And of the leaders of the terrorist movement, you actually come back again and again, I'm sure, in your research, to this Muslim writer who essentially was the DNA for them all. And tell us about him and who he is.
Sayyid Qutb. And fascinating guy. It's always interesting how all these movements always go back to a book, mm-hmm. whether it's, you know, Marxism or, you know, animal rights. You know, there's always some mm-hmm. book at the bottom of it. And the book that is at the bottom of radical Islam is titled Ma'alam fil Tariq, which means signposts along the way, or milestones, as it's usually translated. Written by Sayyid Qutb, an Egyptian educator and philosopher who came to America in 1948. And he's sort of the template for the Islamists who discovered themselves as radicals in the West. He hated America. And it was a time when America's standing in the world had never been higher.
This would be the late 40s when he came
1948,
here.
1948.
Yeah.
You know, just after the war, in the moment when Israel was being created, he spent most of his time in Greeley, Colorado, a little northern Colorado town. They had an education college that was predominantly female. It was a temperance colony. Mm-hmm. And you would think that this middle-aged, you know, teetotaling Egyptian virgin would find this an ideal environment, because it's like a church on every corner, no bars, yet he saw an America that in fact we weren't ready to see ourselves. He was a dark Egyptian, for instance, and one of his roommates from Greeley said that, you know, they'd gone to the theater one time. And he loved theater and movies, but the theater owner said, "You can't come in because you're Negroes." And one of the group said, "No, we're Egyptians." And the theater owner said, "Oh, well, very well, come on in." And Qutb drew himself up and said, "Well, if you will not let a black American in, mm-hmm. this black Egyptian refuses to enter." Mm-hmm. So he saw that dark side, you know, the racial stain on America at a time when we didn't acknowledge it. But so, the sex was also really, really threatening to him. Women were very, you know, these rather liberated farm and ranch girls that came to school. They really posed a dilemma.
And his work is essentially a compelling statement of the irreconcilableness between modernity and Islam, and leading him to conclude that the two could never be reconciled, and that we were at war.
Yeah, he actually in Ma'alam fil Tariq, his main thesis is that there is no such thing as Islam, because in order to practice Islam, you have to live in an Islamic society, and such a thing doesn't exist. In order to create pure Islam, we have to return to the 7th century when the Prophet and his immediate successors ruled. It's not that they were turning against technology, but the social norms and the conventions of the invasion of the West, all of those things that we call modernity, he was very opposed to. And he called for a vanguard of Muslim youth to rise up and overthrow these repressive regimes that were controlling the Arab societies, and create a true Islamic society. And it was that clarion call that awakened Ayman al-Zawahiri, and then thousands, maybe millions, of young Muslims.
Zawahiri, let's get to him. He was a doctor. Yeah. He comes from two distinguished family lines, both right. his on his mother's side and his father's side. He essentially, Q-Tip came back to Egypt and was killed in prison by the
Egyptian...
Hanged.
He was hanged. Nasser hanged him.
Hanged by the Egyptian authorities. Yeah. And at that time, Zawahiri was 15
right.
and actually started his first... I don't know if it was actually a terrorist cell.
No,
but
it was.
It was a terrorist cell.
Started a cell to overthrow the Egyptian government. I guess they weren't really practicing mm-hmm. terror, but they were plotting a coup.
Yeah.
He had a family connection to Said Qutb. Zawahiri's uncle, Mahfouz Azam, a very distinguished labor lawyer in Cairo, was Qutb's lawyer and was the last man to see him alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was very, very close to Said Qutb. And 1966, the year that that Nasser hanged Said Qutb, is the same year that Zawahiri started his cell to overthrow mm-hmm. the Egyptian government.
And he came to be driven by the ideas that Q-Tip had defined, as
right.
is the case with most of these the senior leaders of what was
right.
to become Al-Qaeda.
Said Qutb's work is still very much alive.
Mm-hmm.
And, when I worked in Saudi Arabia, every Friday, the holy day, there would be passages from Said Qutb's, one of his commentaries on the Quran. He's still quite revered.
Mm-hmm. Now, Zawahiri was an Egyptian nationalist, essentially, as I understand it from reading your book, and that what he sought was, through a coup, to change the government, which was then a military government, both under Nasser and under Sadat,
mm-hmm.
And to change it and to bring into being this ideal that Q-Tip had talked about.
I would change the term Egyptian nationalist to Egyptian chauvinist.
Okay.
It's a distinction that may not mean a lot, but Zawahiri doesn't want to create an Egyptian, just an Islamic state in Egypt. He wants to create an Islamic theocracy with a caliph at the head of it, in which there are no real national boundaries.
I see.
But he believes that, as an Egyptian, that Egypt is the most important country in the Arab world, the intellectual capital, and that's where the caliphate should have its seat.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, which is a beautiful rendering of the lives of the various people that we've mentioned, what these lives interface with is a series of global events, mm-hmm. essentially, that keep happening, that involve U.S. intervention in the region, which creates situations which lead to a mobilization and, in essence, a meeting of like minds.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to ask you about this because I think we have to talk about this American presence. And in a way, after reading your book and other books, Steve Cole's book, Ahmed Rashid, America over the period that we're discussing creates... makes three strategic errors. It supports the Mujahideen against the Soviets and then abandons the country, Afghanistan, when the Soviets leave. It, in stopping Saddam Hussein in his invasion of Kuwait,
mm-hmm.
it puts troops into Saudi Arabia and keeps them there. And then finally, we have the Iraq War. So in each of these cases, the unintended consequences of what we do mobilizes these people, sort of
mm-hmm.
changes the equation for them all and brings them together. Talk a little about that.
Well, let's start with 1979, which mm-hmm. was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. In terms of mistakes, this was the Soviet Union's biggest mistake, mm-hmm. and it was done almost accidentally. There doesn't seem to have been anybody that really talked about it. It was almost thought of as a kind of gesture of support for the Afghan government. They needed bolstering, and but suddenly they found themselves involved in a full-fledged invasion, and they were caught. They were caught in for 10 years, the Red Army was in Afghanistan fighting a losing battle. This was a turning point in the perceptions of radical Islamists. 1979 also was the same year that Ayatollah Khomeini took power in Iran. So suddenly the idea that Islam could come to power over a very important country, was given real shape. And with the Soviets in Afghanistan and young Muslims from throughout the world coming to fight against them, it gave focus to this aspiration of, becoming a single community once again, that the Ummah, the radical, the Muslim community would all be one. Mm-hmm. It's a utopian dream, but it was given some substance by that. And the fact that the Soviet Union withdrew in 1989 and then simply fell apart, collapsed, it was like a magical moment in the minds of bin Laden and his followers. And not only did they push the Soviets out of Afghanistan, and they didn't. Let me just make it clear. They were a negligible force. It was the Afghans themselves that did this.
And not the Arabs.
Not the Arabs who weren't there to help them.
Yeah.
But in bin Laden's mind, or at least in his spin doctor view of it, they had provided the mortal blow. Mm-hmm. They had rendered the Soviet Union inoperative. They had destroyed it. In the mind of every Muslim, there's the memory that there was once only one superpower, and it was Islam. And so, for Muslims to have delivered the mortal blow against one of the superpowers, was extremely potent. And it was bin Laden's idea that he could provoke the U.S. to make the same mistake, to follow into Afghanistan the way that the Soviets had done, to come into the killing ground and have Muslim armies swarm upon them, and then maybe the United States become the disunited States, and that leaves the field open for Islam to reclaim its rightful place among powers.
Now, Osama bin Laden was, in a way, like Zawahiri. He was a Saudi, not an Egyptian, but he was concerned about change within Saudi Arabia and change about changing the regime to be I guess you would call it a positive Islamic State instead of a corrupt Islamic State, as he came to see it. So he goes back after this, and in the end, the next step in radicalizing him is basically he thought that he could organize a jihadist legion to fight Saddam Hussein as he threatened Saudi Arabia after invading Kuwait. And so this is the second radicalizing impetus, because what really bothered him is when Turkey and the leaders of Saudi Arabia turned him down and then invited or accepted the U.S. request to come in briefly, but then we stayed.
That was a mistake the worst mistake is staying. Former counterterrorism czar Dick Clark told me that we went in 1990-91 for the war against Iraq. But by 92, Clark says, he had already negotiated base leasing agreements with enough different places outside of the Saudi Peninsula that we could have left. But these were really nice bases, and they were very comfortable. There is a real reason that this was provocative for bin Laden, and not just bin Laden, but many Muslims. when the Prophet Muhammad died on his deathbed, he said, "Let there be no two religions in Arabia." Now, at the time of his death, there were many Jews and Christians living in the Arabian Peninsula. So what that meant was a little mysterious. And some decades after that, the holy cities of Mecca and Medina were declared off-limits. But for some absolutists like bin Laden, the entire Arabian Peninsula is holy because of the Prophet's injunction. And so to have 500,000 infidels, as he would see them, Jews and Christians and more galling women, come in and defend the Arabs, this was an intolerable insult. And yet I think it could have been sustained if we had simply removed ourselves to those other bases after Saddam Hussein was... We were there to enforce the no-fly rule against the Iraqis. But that could have been done elsewhere.
Your book, and it's beautifully written. If I haven't said that, I should say that again. And again, you are telling the story by weaving the profile of especially these actors on the terrorism side. And if I could draw out one important set of results that comes from this period that we're talking about, from the defeat of Saddam Hussein in the first Gulf War and Osama bin Laden's and Zawahiri's turn toward global terrorism. They, over time, came to meet and reach decisions collectively, which involved two very important changes in the world of ideas among jihadists. One was, you identify as the decision that innocent people could be killed, and the other was that the real enemy was not the near enemy, not the Saudi government, not the Egyptian government, but the United States. Mm. Talk about that and why these two changes in thinking were so important.
Well, the first one, Zawahiri, was really the innovator, and he bombed the Egyptian embassy in Islamabad in 1995, and it was a subject of a lot of controversy in his own movement, because the Quran's very specific about, you know, not taking innocent lives. And basically, Zawahiri maintained that there were no innocents. You know, everyone who worked in the embassy was working for the Egyptian government. And okay, there were children who died and maybe some true believers, but we're in such a state of emergency that, you know, we're so weak that these rules have to be relaxed. And the other thing about the near enemy and the far enemy, this is a fundamental distinction in jihadi discourse. Basically, the tradition that Zawahiri comes from maintains that you fight the enemy who's close at hand first. And that's why he wanted to take over the Egyptian government. You know, that was his immediate goal. But the Egyptian government crushed his movement. America's a softer target. And the argument was, it's not distant. It's everywhere. Look at the, you know, the planes in the sky and the, you know, the ships in the sea and the aid that's given to support Mubarak and the rulers of Egypt and other repressive Arab regimes. America's not a distant enemy. It's right at hand. So with that kind of argument, you know, the guns were turned on America.
Mm-hmm. And it is also the case that the jihadists came to believe that it would be ideal if American troops would be drawn back into the Middle East. And their idea was that if they attacked and then we came back at them in Afghanistan, that the U.S. would be destroyed in Afghanistan.
Right.
They were wrong about that. But then the third strategic mistake may have been, or I will ask you, the invasion of Iraq, because then that created the situation where American forces were back on Middle East soil in a war situation.
Iraq looks a lot like what bin Laden had in mind for us in Afghanistan. If you read the memoirs of the inner circle in Al-Qaeda and some of their ideologues, they confess that Al-Qaeda was essentially dead after November, December 2001 when American and coalition forces swept aside the Taliban and pummeled Al-Qaeda, accomplishing in a few weeks what the Red Army had failed to do in 10 years. Thus, 80% of Al-Qaeda membership was captured or killed, according to their own figures. And although we didn't get the leaders, you know, the survivors were scattered, unable to communicate with each other, destitute, and repudiated all over the world. So this was a movement that was in a kind of zombie-like state. It was Iraq that set the prairie on fire. That gave them another chance. Ironically, Iraq was never on bin Laden's list of a likely candidate for jihad because he knew it was a largely Shia nation. And Al-Qaeda, of course, is an entirely Sunni organization. So it wasn't high on his list. It wasn't on his list. But we gave him an opportunity, and he took it.
Do you have a theory of history? Because it seems that you really believe, now I'm putting words in your mouth, but I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, that you really see these individual personalities and their coming together and their interaction with each other. I have in mind here especially Zawahiri and bin Laden created something that really was a pivot for history as it unfolded.
Mm-hmm. If it weren't for Zawahiri and bin Laden, we wouldn't be having this conversation, Harry. There wouldn't be an Al-Qaeda. Before bin Laden, there were numerous radical Islamist groups that were nationalists in their focus. They were intent on, you know, taking over their own countries. It was not exactly, you know, worldwide, you know, Islamist, radical Islamist upsurge as it has become. It was bin Laden who had the imagination to forge this umbrella and get everyone to turn their attention to America and the West. And it was Zawahiri who gave him the men and the managerial experience to accomplish, you know, what he was setting out to do. You can think of this as a vector of these two forces. But absent those two men, there wouldn't be an Al-Qaeda. There would always be, I think, a lot of, you know, smaller groups with narrow political goals. But this is really the invention of these two men.
Let's go back to Anil, because in a way this character, well, I say character, it's not a novel, but this dedicated FBI agent who sometimes was his own worst enemy,
yeah,
and confronted the bureaucratic warfare within the government. Tell us a little about him and how all of this, in a way, metaphorically, came on his shoulders, because he was on the hunt for the next attack and was blocked and stymied at every instance.
O'Neill was a really brilliant and extremely flawed man. Even as early as 1996, he was alerting his superiors that Al-Qaeda and bin Laden posed a real threat to America. And despite the fact that for years after that, the director of the FBI was assuring the White House that Al-Qaeda posed no threat to the homeland. So there was an antagonism between O'Neill and his superiors. He was always agitating and a kind of a Cassandra figure in some respects. And of course, the things that happened that he predicted did come true. You know, I mean, we were, he said, based on early information, that the attacks in East Africa on the American embassies in Kenya and Nairobi and Tanzania, he said those are Al-Qaeda. And the headquarters didn't believe him, but he was, you know, shown to be true. He said that the coal bombing was al-Qaeda, and he got control of that investigation. He said that, you know, they're going to attack us again, and they're going to hit us here. He said to his friends when he resigned from the bureau, and they said, you know, you'll be safe now, John, because you're going to work at the Trade Center, and they've already struck there. He said, no, they'll come finish the job. So in a way, I don't think of it as being ironic that he went to the Trade Center. It seemed more an acceptance of destiny in some respects, kind of Greek in terms of his understanding that he had fallen, and he kind of accepted that he instinctively put himself at ground zero.
There's a minor character in your book, and he is a Muslim who works for the FBI and is the assistant to O'Neill. His name is Ali Sufan, and I was struck. Well, the comparison that came to my mind was with him and Q-Tip, in the sense that he was a Muslim who accepted modernity and was integrated into American society and was part. Talk a little about that, because it just struck me that it was interesting there that in the first case, the philosopher, he couldn't, his imagination wouldn't allow him to see reconciliation, whereas in the case of this FBI agent, he clearly became an important contributor to American society and a member of American society.
Ali Sufan is a real hero, and no one came closer to stopping 9/11. When the coal bombing happened in October of 2000, John O'Neill had the wisdom to appoint then 29-year-old Ali Sufan the case agent. He was really young. But he spoke Arabic natively. He had the skills and the background to understand who these people are and what they're up to. He was one of 8 Arabic-speaking agents in the FBI at that time, the only one in New York. I think there are fewer now that really speak Arabic natively. And it's a lesson in how valuable such a person is. And what a disaster it is that we haven't taken advantage of, you know, all the Arabic speakers that are in our country to help us in this enterprise. Anyway, Ali, while he was questioning the people involved in the coal bombing, developed leads to a meeting that had taken place earlier that year in January of 2000. Somewhere in Southeast Asia, as it happens in Kuala Lumpur. And 3 times he and O'Neill queried the CIA asking for information about this meeting. And 3 times the CIA refused to respond. Just set aside 9/11, what happened. Sufan is investigating the death of 17 American sailors. And the CIA is essentially obstructing justice, refusing to help him. They knew about the meeting in Kuala Lumpur. Mm-hmm. They had surveilled it. They had the Malaysian authorities surveil it for them. They had photographs of the participants, who included some of the plotters of the coal bombing, but also 2 future 9/11 hijackers who flew from Kuala Lumpur to Los Angeles and then to San Diego. And in March of 2000, the CIA knew that 2 members of al-Qaeda were in America, and they refused to tell the FBI. This is one of those parallels with my movie that I find really regrettable. That, you know, the inability of these 2 organizations to work together. Had the CIA shared that information with the FBI, which they were really obligated to do, once they're on American soil, they really belong to, they're part of the FBI's jurisdiction. The Bureau had all the authority it needed legally because they were in al-Qaeda and they were subsumed under the bin Laden indictment to follow these men, to wiretap them, to clone any computer. They didn't need any illegal wiretaps or warrants. They had already all the authority they needed. And they had 20 months before 9/11 to do their work had they been given the knowledge that Al-Qaeda was in America. But that information was shielded from them.
As you look back on your movie in this book, I'm curious, it's very clear that through words and stories and cinema and book, you're trying to affect our imagination and the way we think about the Muslim world and how we should respond and think about terrorism. Talk a little about that. I mean, what do you hope to achieve in these works?
I guess that I think right now we're in a vacuum of political leadership and diplomatic leadership. It falls on journalists in an odd way to do a more critical job of informing the public than we might otherwise be in. And the imaginative, creative community, which has until recently not done a very good job of dealing with 9/11 and our response to it, but I think that is beginning to. But it's more on the intellectual class and the creative class to really address these problems, because we have such a failure of leadership and of an understanding at that level. So I guess there's a sense of being drawn into the void that I feel, because I've been blessed with the background that I have, that I've been called to duty. Mm-hmm. I have to present myself in the service of, we're in a really critical moment, Harry, and it's not going to be resolved anytime soon. It's going to last for a long time, and we have made a ton of mistakes. So it's right now I'm hoping to enlighten people a little bit about the nature of our adversaries and the kinds of things that we can do to lessen the strife. I always feel that things are dangerous when they become simple, when it's good and evil and us versus them, when West versus Islam, when these kinds of paradigms are thrown up, things get very simple and they get very dangerous because they're polarizing. And the role of an investigative reporter or of a movie maker, someone that takes these issues seriously, is to complicate issues. Mm-hmm. And by complicating, you make things more human and therefore less dangerous.
And if students were to watch this program, or the general public, what would you tell, especially the students, about what they should draw from this story and your career, about how they should prepare for the future, where these conflicts with the Islamic world will be there, and how should they think about that or think about preparing themselves to be ready to deal with it in some leadership capacity?
I think the first thing is to not be afraid to engage. And it's the absence of engagement that has been such a liability for us. I think it's really important that Americans get out in the world and experience the world and also present their own American perspectives. People are hungry. America represents something really potent in the world. And it's interesting, when 9/11 happened, I felt, and I think many Americans felt, oh, we're going to have to stand for something now. Our parents have been tested, our grandparents, our forefathers, and it's our turn now. And in many ways, that feeling's been lost. And yet, that's really valuable, because we do have a great treasure that the world depends upon. I was in Syria recently, and a young Syrian filmmaker said to me, what have you done with your country? You know, I live in a police state, but when I look at you now, I see us. Now, that's a perception that we can't afford to have. He needs, you know, we need to control our own society. We need to protect the things that are really valuable and uniquely American. And we need to be able to provide a model for the world. We do have that duty. And it is our turn to protect it. And the students are going to be coming into their own in a period of real difficulty. It's not an easy time. I think that learning foreign languages is very important, and living abroad is extremely important. And also standing up for the things that you feel are really vital to your society, those kinds of things, you are going to be tested. This is not a generation that's going to get away easily.
Larry, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being our guest. And let me show your book again and suggest that everybody go out and buy it, The Looming Tower. And again, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Harry,
today.
Thank you. It's been a fun time. I enjoyed it.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.